Good morning. I'm Al Zaponte, your moderator for the second and final session for the morning. I'm also the President and CEO of the U.S.-Mexico Chamber of Commerce. I want to first thank Catherine Bliss for all her hard work. This would not have happened without her really not only changing the date because of our storm, but also putting this together in pretty short order. And thank you for coming. This will be a beginning, as she probably have said to you, and the other conspirator, Ed K. Dunk. Ed, are you here? Are you visiting the little boys' room? Okay. Hurry up, Ed. Richard Salvatierra and a whole group of us of the three organizations, CSIS, the Pan American Health and Education Foundation, and our chamber, to try to bring a focus not only here in Washington but also on the U.S.-Mexican border in the challenge of chronic diseases along the border. Our roundtable this morning is innovative solutions in addressing the challenge of chronic diseases along the U.S.-Mexican border. One of the things that I think we all have seen and heard and try to really understand is what's really going on transborder, both migration, flows of labor mobility, and along with that, the various type of chronic diseases that may be brought by those populations, not just Mexico, but specifically the U.S.-Mexican border. This morning we have three speakers, and what I would like to do, have all of you seen the bio on the, so I will not bore you with that other than to tell you that we feel very, very fortunate to have three individuals that will bring focus on very specific areas and to looking at what has been the experience and what are some of the hopefully best practices that we move forward into the next few years. And first we have Jennifer Cabe of Canyon Ranch Institute. Jennifer works with a very dear friend of mine. In fact, we were both in special forces together. Richard Carmona, so tell him I'm mad he didn't show up. And I'm going to go sneak up on him. Anyway.
Good luck.
Yeah, right. You haven't found him either, huh?
No, I mean sneaking up on him.
Yeah, right.
He has eyes in the back of his head.
And I don't know, Sally, have you been introduced appropriately? If not, I'm going to do it a second time. Ambassador Shelton Kobe, who's a dear friend, knows quite a bit about Mexico, worked in the State Department, has done a lot. Especially in transparency and the whole area of anti-corruption, and we were just talking about that. That's something hopefully also this town gets a better understanding of. So at this time, Jennifer Cabe.
So what I'm going to be doing today is building a lot upon what was discussed earlier this morning, but with a bit of an overlay of health literacy, which many of you here are familiar with, both in research and in practice. And the reason why I'm going to be talking about health literacy in the context of disease prevention is because what we have found in all of our programs globally is that by really engaging with this measure of health literacy, which is something that really does work in all the domains, we're able to get to the behavior change and then the health outcomes, physical and physiological, that we're so seeking. My health literacy lens is a fairly traditional, started in a very traditional way, working in plain language and then moving into the broader definition of health literacy. And it was while working with Dr. Carmona, who Al mentioned earlier, who was the Surgeon General of the United States from 2002 to 2006, that we visited with and met with then Secretary of Health for Mexico, Julio Frank, who many of you, I'm sure, know, has a perspective on health and policy in that health should be in all policy, whether it's transportation or education, environment, and so on. And that is what led us to this focus on health literacy. So working with Dr. Carmona and others at HHS and USDA, and primarily those two departments, but also with policymakers and policy brokers on the Hill and the White House and in schools. We did do some work with Ed and in communities as well as in nonprofit organizations and in big companies. And one of the things that Dr. Carmona absolutely mandated was that we have a version of all of the communications that were issued from the Office of the Surgeon General, whether it was on bone health and osteoporosis or the health and wellness of people with disabilities or tobacco, so on and so forth, that every time there would be something that would be usable by the average citizen. And in every possible way, we worked to translate this information for various cultures and communities. And we had a lot of help in doing that from state departments of health, county departments of health, big companies that stepped in and helped with that, a lot of the different centers and institutes of the NIH. But it was funny, when he came into office, he asked, okay, so we issue these Surgeon General reports that really do, you know, change the world globally when it comes to public health. Who do we issue these for? And the staff said to him, well, it's for our colleagues, the public health practitioners. Oh, well, it's for the scientists. So it's the researchers, the clinicians. And then somebody had the nerve to say, no, they're for the people. And Dr. Carmona said, I don't know any people who are going to read this 800-page, you know, report on tobacco. And he said, I got to tell you, in the jobs that I've had, what these have served to be is something people put on their bookshelf, and you feel very important because you have one of these reports. But they don't get translated into the lives and the behavior and the realities of anybody. So that's why we did these people's pieces, which you can see up here on the screen right now. And the work that we now do at Canyon Ranch Institute, which is based in Arizona in the beautiful and fragile and dangerous Sonoran Desert that's been mentioned several times today, is imbued with the practice of health literacy. And this is a quote from Dr. Carmona. And this really does get to also what we believe so strongly in, which is an integrative approach to health, a holistic approach, mind, body, spirit, emotion, the whole person. And I was so gratified to hear several times today from the expert panel the discussion of the need for behavior change that's backed up by social support, by also the connection to psychology and emotion and that aspect of wellness. That's a lot of what we're also working in, dealing with issues of depression that often lead to all of the other issues that we talk about. And really treating the brain as another organ of the body. And when there's something wrong with an organ of the body, we address that. Same thing with the brain. We work in partnership always. We have a different model in that whether we are receiving funds or contributing funds to a program, once the funding is done, we don't talk about the money again. We don't talk about, well, you owe us a report or we owe you a report. It is truly meant to be working in equitable partnerships, which is something that we felt was really important, especially after leaving government now close to 3 years ago, in that so many times in the past, and this is really being addressed, I think, in many extraordinary ways, particularly by the CDC, but in the past, it was all about, okay, we're going to give you some money, and you're going to give us a report in 2 years. See you then. And that really didn't create partnerships. That didn't really create a way to build a team that was, as somebody mentioned earlier today, I thought it was a really great point, multifunctional, in that we're not all doing the same thing. But if we're not talking to each other, of course we're all going to be doing the same thing, and there's going to be overlap instead of, okay, you're expert at this area, you're expert at this area, let's have you focus here and have you focus here and always be talking with each other. So whether we're working with the Cleveland Clinic or the Lance Armstrong Foundation or the Melanie and Zuckerman College of Public Health at the University of Arizona, which was also mentioned earlier today, or in one of the small communities that we work with Promotoras and with the participants in programs, it's always with this idea of what is it that you do best? What are you honoring what people have done before and what they're doing now and what it is that they're really striving to have happen in their communities in a way that is first sustainable and then replicable, and we're starting to get some traction in that way. One of the things that I do want to briefly mention, and I was thinking about Dr. Carmona because he led this workshop that we just had a couple of days ago here in D.C., bringing together the community of people who worked to develop the National Call to Action on Cancer Prevention and Survivorship. And just to back up what somebody said earlier today about how difficult it is to really bring in all the different sectors who need to be represented when you're working on an issue, and how it's so easy and fun to go back to the same people we always work with because we like them and we know who we can, you know, get things really galvanized with. And it's so much more difficult to reach out to the other communities multisectorally that really do affect the work that we're trying to do. And this is what we've been able to do with working with essentially using the celebrity of Lance Armstrong as well as the celebrity in certain circles of the United States Surgeons General. The four most recent Surgeons General issued this national call to action in 2008. A couple of days ago, Dr. Carmona led the fourth workshop of this group that's working to advance the strategies and achieve the four goals that the Surgeons General put forward. And we were really happy to have not only people from the world of health, but also people from the world of urban planning and talking about the built environment, people from industry and labor and faith-based. And there were a lot of people who were, you know, coming together for the first time, and they were really excited about being able to report in the strategies that they'd adopted to meet these goals. And as we talked about earlier, so many of the ways that we can prevent and mitigate the chronic diseases that are costing us so much in terms of time and lives and money and happiness are the same. So one of the things I would encourage you to do is take a look at the website for this national call to action, which is nctacancer.org. And it talks in there about how this community was built, and everybody's reporting in about what they're doing, and people are contributing time, money, and energy to work toward achieving these goals. We were so excited also to have letters from people who serve in important positions in the White House and on the Hill and at HHS, et cetera, as well as the HHS Assistant Secretary for Health, Howard Koh, come in and say, okay, here's what HHS is doing to meet these goals. So it's an example of private and public and everybody coming together to work on an issue. I'm not going to read all of these, but this is getting to what I mentioned just a moment ago about how Canyon Ranch Institute views health literacy, and this is not our singular view. This is the approach that's really been taken up. Particularly, it's very interesting to know, in countries other than the United States, this approach to health literacy that's really about in all the different domains, from education to society and culture. And, of course, the sector that you would usually connect health literacy with, which is the healthcare sector and the literacy or the writing and reading sectors that have come together and been big leaders. And health literacy is the coin that we use, the currency that we use, because it does affect everything that can happen in health and in particularly in disease prevention with all of the sectors that have already been discussed today. I don't think I need to go over these data that have to do with when we look at how do we avoid disease and death, and we know that those really have to do with behavioral and environmental factors, and then what do we invest? And it's right now terribly upside down. This slide is another one I won't read out loud. I don't know if there's a plan to put slides. I'd love to have some of the other ones maybe up on your website or something in some way, Catherine. But these are the things that we really are pushing, funding, and in any way that we can, helping others to resource health literacy in demonstration projects in public health to address exactly the problems that we're talking about today. So these are the solutions that I'm trying to sort of weave through what I'm discussing today. And one of the things that's always very confusing to people, I think, about health literacy and that I just want to address right now is that there's a difference between ensuring that programs are accessible to people with low health literacy, which is, by the way, the most of the population, and it's not even necessarily about what level of education you've attained, high school and college and beyond, but the fact that you could be somebody who's very well educated in a field that has no connection with health. You could also be somebody who is actually a health practitioner, but when you are stressed or in pain, you are going to have a lower level of health literacy and not understand what it is that the health professional is sharing with you or what you're trying to get the information about in order to be healthier. But what we do is really design programs to advance health literacy with partners so that all these other things can be achieved. Prospectively identifying and measuring outcomes that I've mentioned earlier, and going through all these things to the extent of really trying to create such equity that you eliminate health disparities. One of the programs that we have really put a lot of time and money and energy into is an adaptation of the CDC curriculum Pasos Adelante, which I think was mentioned earlier, is used primarily with adults. And when we first encountered it, it was used primarily in border communities with older women. And there were some really nice successes with older women forming walking groups and these kind of support structures that really did lead to weight loss and then maintenance of that weight loss, and then that affected all the chronic diseases that we've been talking about so much today. So what we did is take that curriculum, Spanish language curriculum, and with the Melanie and Zuckerman College of Public Health at the University of Arizona and community partners, we adapted it to be for mothers of young children. And the children, most of them are enrolled in Head Start programs. And then we also, through a program called Family Literacy, which is adult basic education, we infused that program with in English, Healthy Steps for Families, with these health and wellness messages. And we've affected now health and well-being of over 300 of the parents, which affects many more times the number of children when you think about families. And it was very, very difficult. It was very difficult to get into the communities in ways that we felt were going to really be in trusting relationships and therefore sustainable. First thing they had us do was do it as a workplace wellness program with the Head Start staff. And then they said, okay, we like you. You can come in. Even though we'd worked with them many times before, as had the folks from the U of A, but it was still, okay, you want to do something new with our people, to our people? Let's see who you are first, which is totally fair. So that's what we did for a year. And then now for the past 2 years, we've been actually working with the moms. And I brought a bunch of brochures that have the story of what's been happening in this program. And right now, this program is the funding of the program is very uncertain. We put in $500,000 3 years ago, so we were really working on, you know, little budget here. But our partners are the ones who really made it happen. And in the state of Arizona, you may know that cuts are absolutely just imminent for anything that has to do with adult basic education. And without the partners there to bring the program into, we're up a creek. So right now we're trying to figure out what we're gonna do. We've got a program that's very well accepted, good measurable outcomes, and don't know exactly how we're gonna do it next. Another program that has been successful and we are finding to be more sustainable because it has even more of the integrative approach. The Healthy Steps for Families is diet, nutrition, and physical activity. The Life Enhancement Program, which we built from the ground up as a Spanish and English language program to advance health literacy, and therefore affect behavior change and physical and physiological outcomes to the positive, is much more integrative when you talk about nutrition and cooking, food shopping, physical activity, integrative medicine, stress management, spirituality, and a lot of social support, people meeting, people eating together, cooking together, et cetera, et cetera. And we've got three demonstration projects going. We train the health professionals, 10 to 15 health professionals, at Canyon Ranch in Tucson, which is a very nice place to come and get your training. And then what we do with each of the partners is build the curriculum around what they need and also build what they need. And in the South Bronx, for example, which was primarily recent immigrant population, mostly from Puerto Rico, and we tried everything, trust me, with trying to not build a health and wellness center in this federally qualified community health center. We looked at walking. We looked at the YMCA availability. There was nothing. There was nothing, and people didn't feel the least bit safe going out and walking. So we built this health and wellness center that you see up on the screen. We have had change at individual and community level that we're very, very proud of. One of the things that came out is people said, oh, I can dance? And that counts as physical activity? Great. And so they put on dance parties and all this kind of thing. I'm going to just wrap up here. Thank you, Al. And one of the things that I really want to mention that has to do with change at the community level is that when the health professionals at the Urban Health Plan, which is the community health center, knew that they were going to be teaching about fresh fruits and vegetables, they said, you know, people don't have access to this here. There was a little bodega on the corner that sold mostly chips and, you know, whatever, candy and alcohol. And they went to that bodega and they said, do you think if we guaranteed that our people would buy the fruits and vegetables that maybe something could happen here to put this in? And they said, well, we'll see. They put it in. That was 3 years ago, 2.5 years ago. Now, when you go back, all you see when you walk past that corner is a huge amount of fresh fruits and vegetables. There's now ability to pay for that with your WIC card, and it's really one of the leading sellers for that store. And we did a lot of talk about, oh, well, maybe we should open up a little farmer's market, blah, 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 blah. And one of the things that Dr. Carmona said is, I don't think you want to go into competition with the local merchants. Don't do that. Go to the local merchants and work with them. And it really wasn't that hard. They said, okay, whatever, we'll give it a try, and it's been a huge success. That's a picture of dancing, if you can't tell. I will skip past this, but basically this is to give you a little bit more information about the empowerment aspect of when you tell somebody, your doctor visit's for you. It's not about the doctor, it's for you. Go in prepared and know that this is your time and the effect that we've seen there. Let's see. What's next? And I just want to take a quick second here. We would invite anybody here to reach out to us to work with us on taking particularly the Life Enhancement Program into border communities. We have partners we could work with there. We would love more partners in more communities. Like I said, right now we're in three places, and we'd like to continue to expand it. And we do it in ways that are easy and fun. We're good to work with, we promise. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Jennifer. Next, I'd like to ask Josephine Garza, the National Latino Children's Institute.
Thank you. I've been with the National Latino Children's Institute now for about eight years, but have been at the inception of this organization that's only 13 years old. One of the things that we do is that we transcreate. We take information that sometimes can be difficult because none of us are health workers at our organization. We all come mostly from education and working in early childhood and education of families. And we take that information and we not just translate it, but make sure that the culture, aside from the language, is used in all of the materials that we do because we want to take that into consideration with the families. And I sometimes it changed all of my fonts here for some reason. One of the things that we did, we worked with craft foods, and they approached us on this program that we developed called Salsa Sabor y Salud. And we never translate our titles. They're always in Spanish. But we do say it's creating healthy lifestyles for Latino families with children ages 3 to 12. And basically, 8 years ago, we were looking at the issue of childhood obesity and what did we need to do. So we called in we did our literature review. We saw all the research that was out there, which was very little at that time. And a lot of it was based on Mexican Americans mostly and not on other Latino groups. And so we began to say, okay, well, there's a lot of holes here, so what is it that we need to do? So that we called in the experts, the nutritionists, the physical fitness experts, and said, what do we need to do? And if we develop a program, what components should that program have? So then we took all that information, developed our questionnaires, and we went out and did focus groups. We talked to the families, parents, grandparents, tías, tíos, whoever wanted to come and talk to us about, if you had a program that addressed healthy lifestyles, what would you want it to look like? And why are you not, or why are you doing some of these things? And we also interviewed and held focus groups with children ages 7 to 12. They're always fascinating. And then we also had focus groups with frontline staff workers and then other focus groups with community leaders and the health people within those communities to try to get the most information as possible. Because before we design any program, this is our approach. We want to get information from the people themselves. So then, of course, we came back and began to look at what is it that we're going to do. And so we did. You know, we asked the families, what's keeping you from doing this? And a lot of them felt like the traditions were hard to change. I don't care what group it was, some kind of tamal was the issue. How can you change my tamal and make it healthy? And, you know, what is it going to do? Whatever Latino group you're talking to, there was a form of tamal, whether it was wrapped in a corn husk or whether it was wrapped in banana leaves. So, you know, it's like they were concerned about their tamal. And then also about the information that they were getting was confusing and that it wasn't in their language. And it wasn't, or if even if it was in their language, they still didn't understand the information that was being given to them. And then they also felt that many of the programs that they did go to, they felt like they were being punished. And they didn't like having that feeling because they already felt bad about working two or three jobs, not spending time with their families, doing all of these things. And so so they wanted something that didn't make them feel bad, but that really made them feel good about themselves and what they were doing and teaching them from where they were, not necessarily taking things away. And then they talked about when they think about healthy, they also thought it was more expensive. So cost was an issue. And again, all of this is part of the education of the language, of the literacy, and understanding what all of this means. And they also felt that programs were not flexible and that parks and streets were not safe. So a lot of the families couldn't get to parks. Some of the interesting things that have happened since then is some of the families have actually decided that they were taking back the parks. They were their parks. They actually have gone out. They've cleaned up the parks. They've done things because, you know, it belongs to us as well. They also started doing things like in one of the organizations in Chicago, they had a vendor who sold paletas, elote with the mayonnaise and all of that stuff and the Italian fried cookies. Well, one day, he started to notice that people weren't buying it anymore. So he was a little upset because people weren't buying his food. And so he took it upon himself to go inside the center and ask what was going on. Were the people telling them not to buy their food? And they said, no, we just started a new program on healthy lifestyles so people are more conscientious about what they're eating. So the next day he came back with the corn, but instead he had limes and lemons and he had roasted nuts. And I said, you know, it can make an impact on you. If it makes an impact on your wallet, you're going to change what you do. And what we did is we developed an 8-week curriculum that teaches families about healthy lifestyles. So there is a fitness and a nutrition piece to each session. And they're broken down by different guides, one for the children, one for the parents, And, well, actually, yes, one for the children, one for the parents, and there's a coordinator's handbook. And we actually ended up translating the entire curriculum. Normally, the curriculums are in English, but we found that with this one, we had to translate because many of the facilitators did not speak English themselves. We started working and training promotores in the community, and we started training other people because this curriculum was actually made for people who did not have to have a nutrition degree. Not for dietitians, not for anybody. This was for lay people who wanted to really make a difference. I call this program a baby step. It's actually like a pre-baby step. Because some of the other things the parents told us was, do not use the word exercise, do not use the word diet, because we won't do it. And they said, because then it sets up all these other kinds of images. And so, of course, we had to fight with a nutritionist who wanted to immediately check BMIs and wanted to do all of this stuff. I said, did you not listen to what the family said to us? And so what we did is that we then created this program. Right now we're in about 20 communities, including Puerto Rico, and have trained over 400 program staff, have reached more than 32,000 participants, and are actually working and been talking with PAHEF on the possibility of how do we then use this or adapt this program to work on the border. And I understand the border very well. I'm 13th generation Texan, and sometimes people say, but that was probably before Texas even belonged to the United States. I said, exactly. I said, so for us, the fluidity of going between borders at one time, it was like no big deal. Now with the border walls, I was very interested, Dr. Cicada, about the stress and all of those issues because I just recently was in Brownsville looking at some of that and what the causes of that and the impact on mental health, on the stress and family. But anyway, that's something that we've been talking about with different partners in looking at what is it that we can do, because it is a real crucial area that we need to do something. And the border is its own world. It is not like any other place. And we do pre- and post-test. And I know this is hard to read. I don't know why I changed my fonts. But we recently just finished up our 2009 statistics and found that 97% learned a lot about nutrition and how to achieve it. 92% understood portion size, because that was always a shocker when we did the presentation on portion sizes. They're like, that's a portion? I said, yes, just because you serve your plate does not mean that's the portion. And that they also learned a lot about how to make things healthier. On the fitness side, 87% learned a lot about physical activities that can be done at home. Because this is one thing that we were very adamant about, is they have to be able to do them and not cost them a lot of money. So we talk about movement a lot. And we talk about dancing, playing soccer, playing games, playing things that they can do in their house if they don't feel safe going outside the house. We do encourage walking where they can. And so we talk about that, the energy balance. And 99% of them said that they were very satisfied with the program. For many of them, the comment that we heard over and over was that this was the first time they actually felt that there was a program that was done for them, that they could see themselves in it. This was really, so it was very exciting for us, So it was very exciting for us to see that. You know, the one thing that's on that slide that you did, Jennifer, that only 1-3% of funding goes to prevention programs, and so somehow we need to do something. I was at a meeting with NIH, and they were talking, and the title was Research, Policy, and Practice. And I kept asking, where's the practice piece? Because there was a lot of research and a lot of policy, but still hadn't quite gotten to, as what Dr. McQueen was talking about this morning as well, is how do we really bring it all together? Because there are successful programs out there that really do need the support of research and of policy changes, but are on the prevention side. They all have their space of where they need to be. And then The interesting thing, too, is the information that's being shared, not just with the parents or grandparents that are coming, but how they're now talking to their neighbors, so they're passing the information on to their cousins or whoever, other family members. And so the impact of that, I think, could be very interesting. We have had two studies done. One was done by the University of Illinois, and there is some information out there on the findings, and they were actually very good. Our main funder has been Kraft Foods, and that also came with its own kind of issues and challenges, but they have actually been an excellent partner. And there is no mention of any products. We do not go there. We do not talk about any of that. It really is about making an investment in the community. And they also invested in these two studies. And the other one was done out of UCLA, and that one was really looking at an in-school, after-school program and looking at, if you don't have the parents there, how effective is an after-school program with getting the information just through children? And what they found was you need to get parents involved. The kids can't go home and tell mom what they need to do. So it's really important to do that. Of course, the benefits, because the program is cultural and linguistic appropriate, it encourages a whole center approach. It is it really does help build the capacity of organizations, because the other thing that Kraft did is that we really strongly encourage them to also provide implementation grants to the sites. I said we cannot expect them to spend hours implementing a program and not give them any resources when they're already stretched in their own, in the resources that they do have. And about environment and how do we change environment? So one of the things that we're looking at in partners, that we're always looking for partners as well, is how do we complement each other? We have a curriculum that works. You may have the research and everything behind it, and looking at how do we bring it together with organizations that are out there as we are beginning our conversation with PAHEF and other organizations, which is, I think, one of the most important things that we need to do in working together. I think it was Dr. McQueen that talked about how everybody's doing everything on the border, but we all have our niche, and this is what we need to do, because then we can complement each other rather than take away and strengthen the community and give the community the information in a way that is in a way that is successful. Thank you very much.
I never wanted to. Our last speaker is Colonel Dan Reyna, U.S.-Mexico Border Health Commission. Dan?
Well, let me thank you, Al, for that short and different introduction. I'm one of the actors of the border, so first and foremost, let me thank the Academy for having us here and bringing attention to the border. CSIS, Peter, Ed from the Pan American Health Education Foundation, appreciate it. Catherine, for all her hard work and making this happen, and a great adjustment. U.S. On the weather, the U.S. Mexico Chamber of Commerce as well for the great partnership in all of this. Too bad David stepped out, but I wanted to start by saying ditto to David's presentation for sure. I was ready to tell David that from here and henceforth, he will be known as David Moses McQueen. I was ready to see him reach down and grab the two tablets and then just lift them and above his head, and just we go from the Ten Commandments to the Eight Challenges. So I'm looking forward to posting them on my office, David. So I need a good photo, you know. So, great for that. Okay. And good weather, I'm sure. But thank you for the invitation to be here. I'm going to give you just a short overview as to the role and the work of the Border Health Commission. and basically try to have a conversation as time permits for us and deal with the questions that are on your mind. This is the U.S.-Mexico border. You've already seen in other slides, but this is what we call our neighborhood. This is where we do our work. It is a different area of the world, not only of the two countries. And for the U.S. side, we refer to it in some respects as the virtual Region 11. So you mean, some of you may know about the 10 federal regions. Region 6 handles New Mexico and Texas. Region 9 handles California and Arizona. Well, we refer to ourselves as Region 11, and we work the border region. This is what we call the horizontal border, the 10 states, 4 U.S., 6 Mexican states, for 80 municipios on the Mexican side, for the definition of the La Paz Agreement and that of the Border Health Commission, the public health, public law 103-400, it's 44 counties on the U.S. side. We work with 15 sister city communities and binational health councils that we support through the states and through the commission resources. So we basically have a network. The commission becomes a platform and a framework by which we do business horizontally among these players. There's no other framework like it anywhere. In order to be able to do our work horizontally, not one state could take actions relative to the entire border. Not one community could do that. But through the platform and the framework of the U.S.-Mexico Border Health Commission, we're able to do that. And by agreement between the two countries in the year 2000, then we have a binational commission. Beyond the horizontal nature of the U.S.-Mexico border, we work along 5 vertical regions of the border. We call them our 5 vertical borders. A lot of the work is done vertically among our population areas. The majority, great majority, as you saw already and heard, of the population is urban, is in the urban communities, but 70% of the border is rural. And so we bring in the network, the web of the rural communities and the urban cities into these 5 vertical regions and the horizontal border. The commission is a partnership among the two nations, two sections, U.S. and Mexico sections, by public law in the U.S. and national law in Mexico. Our two commissioners are the two secretaries of health, and we have 12 members on each side. For the U.S., we have the 4 state health officers by position, and then we have 2 community members nominated by their governors and appointed by the president. And in Mexico, they have 2 members per state appointed by the Secretary of Health. Beyond this, we also, as I mentioned, have community health councils and work with the sister cities. But on the U.S. side, each of the U.S. border states has an Office of Border Health, and funding through the commission also provides in each of the 4 border states a commission outreach office. On the Mexican side, with Mexican resources, they have each of the 6 Mexican border states has a commission outreach office. So we have offices of border health on the U.S. side and 10 commission outreach offices as well. Our mission is really to provide international leadership for this framework and this capacity to do the work among the 2 nations and the 10 states. 2 primary goals is bring focus to the border health issues and serve as a venue for binational action. Many, many examples of how that is done. In 2006, the commission, at the request of the 2 secretaries, in concert with one of our commission meetings on the Mexican side, basically hosted the first ever worldwide forum on avian flu. We followed that up 3 months later to have a leadership-level tabletop exercise on avian flu. So basically, we were preparing for the H1N1 influenza, very well ahead of time by doing it collectively and border-wide. Our strategic roles involve facilitation, identification, study, and research. We serve as a catalyst to bring awareness to these issues, promote sustainable partnerships, whether through our formal agreements, as we have with many of our partners, or through our annual Mardi Gras event we call Border Binational Health Week in October of each year. And many of you already are familiar with it, but every October we get together on both sides of the border in concert with the third Mexican National Health Week that occurs in October, and also the annual Binational Health Week hosted by the Health Initiative of the Americas that also serves Canada to Chile. And we celebrate, and we bring issues to the border, we bring attention to the border, and we address our partnerships as well. And last October, we had over 140 events throughout the U.S.-Mexico border. And we serve as an information portal to many, many issues. We have a weekly bulletin on border health issues. It's the only one in existence. We have over 1,500 registered persons receiving the bulletin from both countries. And on our website, we're happy to report received over 2.3 million hits in 2009. Our basic chronic disease priorities, this is addressed in our Healthy Border 2010 initiative. This is an initiative that is really unique as well anywhere between two countries and 10 states. This is patterned after the U.S. Healthy People Program, and also the National Indicators for Health in Mexico, Indicadores de Salud. It is a framework whereby four states on the U.S. side get together and develop an effort that addresses the common health objectives on the U.S. side. We started working on this effort before the commission even existed in order to have it ready for the commission upon its launching. On the Mexican side, they have the national health indicators. Once the commission came into play in 2000, we started comparing the basic agreed-upon objectives of the border. There were 25 and the 39 Mexican national health indicators. From the 39 and the 25, we basically agreed on 20. In 2005, became 21 because on the U.S. side, we separated the Hep A and Hep B. So this is basically a significant effort to coalesce among consensus objectives along a binational region and a region in the U.S. There's no other region in the U.S. that does this in a healthy people mode. Some states in the U.S. don't even participate in healthy people, much less have a region that does this collectively. But we do it binationally. We're in the verge now of developing our initiative to close down Healthy Border 2010. As we gather the data and information and so on and do the proper analysis, we've completed our midterm review for 2010 last summer, and it's on our website. You can take it from there. And then beginning the plans to launch Healthy Border 2020. We've been very involved on the U.S. side in the Healthy People 2020 initiative, so we're basically learning lessons as we go along. And believe that this will be a 3 to 5 year initiative to basically close down 2010 and move forward to 2020. Some of the areas in chronic disease focus points that are in Healthy Border 2010 include diabetes, cancer, HIV, and AIDS objectives. But it's a very dynamic approach to how to do things, and it just brings a particular attention to the critical issues of the border. In the area of obesity, diabetes, we're focusing significantly in that. You have in your packet information on the six key priorities of the Board of Health Commission, and childhood obesity is clearly one. It just goes without saying that this is a looming cloud in the horizon for the U.S.-Mexico border region, if not for both countries, as you saw from the other panelists, that every advancement, economic advancement, especially for the Hispanic community along the border that has taken place in the last 20 years, will be for naught if we don't deal with childhood obesity. And one of the issues that we took on last summer is conducting the first ever child and adolescent health forum in El Paso, and we had tremendous presentations, reported on the website, and especially on childhood obesity. I mean, it's going to turn us back a generation or two if we don't really attack this wholeheartedly. So we're very, very interested and involved in moving toward work with the First Lady on her initiative for childhood obesity, and Mexico as well is quite involved in making that connection with the U.S. side. This year, we're targeting a number of things related to childhood obesity and diabetes. One is developing the mechanics of a campaign, multimedia campaign for childhood obesity. And, you know, it's difficult enough to do a campaign in a community, a small community, or even an urban community anywhere in this country. But try to do a campaign that fits a binational community with 10 states, you know, and 15, 16 sister cities and a population of 13 million. You know, when you do border health, you have to be very patient. So, you know, we've learned patience through the years, and it's something that we hit on a few things, and we just stick with it from year to year and make it work. We're updating our reports on border obesity and diabetes, and one of the best things that the commission has done, in 2003, we went through an exercise called the Models of Excellence. We identified the best practices programs that used the promotoras, community health workers along the border. We published that compendium, and basically we brought a lot of attention to a lot of good programs on the border. You know, I was in New Mexico at that time, and two of our programs were selected, and they had already been rewarded for in other venues for the work that they had done, and got a lot of calls from all over the country in the U.S. and even Europe, actually, to hear about how to implement community health worker programs. This year, we're going to focus on the best practices models for childhood obesity prevention. And we hope that what we've heard today and what you all know and what comes to us later is bring attention to these models along the border so they can be replicated and then as well be resourced in the coming years as they would need it to improve on their success. This is my partner, Clemente Villalpando Padilla from the Mexico section, out of Mexico City, and information on how to contact me and how to reach us at the Border Health Commission through our website. We welcome your registration for our weekly bulletin, and you know, feel free to give us your feedback at any time. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dan. We have 5 minutes. So, does anybody have any questions before our panel and we dismiss for the day? Any statements? Everybody's hungry for lunch, I guess. Well, at this time, I want to, again, thank the panel, Jennifer, Josephine, and Dan. This wraps up a beginning of a process that the three organizations feel strong about and that we would like to invite you to the future events that we'll have. We plan to have events on the border along with in both capitals. I would also like to invite you to this evening. We have our 14th annual U.S.-Mexico Congressional Border Issues Conference. It's in the Gold Room of the House Rayburn Building. From 5 to 6:30 this afternoon, we'll have our reception where we honor, and Dan, you were talking about sister cities. We do a honoring of two cities every year, one on the Mexican, one on the U.S. side. This year, we're going to be doing Reynosa and Hidalgo. And then all day tomorrow, the 17th, from 9 to 4:30, we'll be conducting our regular one-day conference and where we'll have three panel discussions, the first one on that will kick off around 9:15, on immigration and labor mobility. The second one will be on trade, commerce, and investment and infrastructure. The keynote at lunch will be by Ambassador Arturo Sarocan of Mexico and Chief Garza of the Border Police. We'll also, in the afternoon, which is going to be a highlight, which we focus on security cooperation and the Merit Initiative. Each one of these three panels are co-hosted by congressmen, congresswomen, and it's by no means that we're going to have eight congressmen on the third and final panel on security. But Senator Cornyn will be at the morning panel, so it'll be a good balance of something that those of you would like to come and visit. Now, there's one thing that I don't know if Catherine mentioned. If we were to have Mayor of Juarez here, and unfortunately he's been kind of busy of late, and I think you've all read about it, and It would have been really great to have him, but we may be able to do something later on with him. At this time, I want to thank Ed and ask Catherine if she'll come up and close the proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you, Al, and thank you to the U.S.-Mexico Chamber of Commerce and to Ed Kadunk and Dick Salvatierra and Genevieve Hernandez and the team at the Pan American Health and Education Foundation as well for the support and collaboration and partnership in developing this this project. And as we look forward, you know, as Peter DeShazo mentioned at the beginning, our goals with organizing sessions focusing on the challenge, raising awareness about the challenge of chronic diseases on the U.S.-Mexico border, and identifying some of the innovative solutions that are being carried out at the binational level through private sector engagement and through the work of nonprofit organizations, are to raise awareness of the issue, facilitate the development and provision of policy recommendations, share best practices and strategies, address barriers to cross-border cooperation, and encourage greater advocacy for a broad spectrum of policy changes. We hope that this will be the first of a series of discussions that will take place in the United States and in Mexico and in what has been identified as perhaps a third country or at least a third region, the border region itself, and among cities and states and communities. So I invite you to listen, if you were not able to participate in the whole conversation this morning, to listen to the presentations on our website, www.csis.org. The audio should be available later this week. We will also be uploading some of the presentations so that you will be able to access those and take a look at some of the great information that was provided at your leisure. And we invite you to continue to be focused on this set of issues and to share your thoughts and recommendations with us as we move forward to continue the dialogue. Thank you very much.